Primary care physicians on the front line of a health crisis now asking for a primary care Marshall Plan to survive long term. That story and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. El Paso, long a Democratic stronghold, but also with a history of low turnout among Latinos and young voters. We'll have a closer look at what issues might get them to the polls with Election Day, now just 50 days away. Also, how one of the biggest legacies of the Obama administration echoes in this election season. And colleges and universities trying to get in good with social media influencers. But at what price? Those stories and a whole lot more when the National News Show of Texas gets underway. And that happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 14th day of September. Hard to believe we're almost halfway through the month on this Monday. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. In the back and forth over whether Harris County will be sending out vote-by-mail applications to all registered voters there, the clerk's office has scored a win. You may recall that state officials led by the Attorney General and the Secretary of State sought a temporary injunction against such a move, claiming that Harris County's clerk, the top election official there, was acting outside his authority by sending out vote-by-mail applications to all 2.4 million registered voters, charging that the move would harm voters and sow confusion. But a Texas district judge has now ruled that while the state does have rules on mail-in voting, the law is silent about how people get an application. So Harris County plans to move forward. We are now exactly 50 days from the general election, 5-0. So far, the courts have held that fear of the coronavirus alone is not sufficient to qualify Texans under age 65 to vote by mail. COVID-19 is almost certain to have an impact on the election, and many predict mayhem in the counting process. But the pandemic is already wreaking havoc on businesses large and small in Texas. While doctors have been critical in the fight against COVID-19, many Texas doctors, especially primary care providers, worry they may not survive economically. Now, a group of them is calling for a primary care Marshall Plan, echoing the name given to the U.S. government's effort to help Europe recover in the aftermath of World War II. Tom Banning is CEO of the Texas Academy of Family Physicians. Tom, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Well, thank you for having me.
Before we get into this Marshall Plan idea, tell us a little bit about the financial situation for family practice doctors in Texas. Since the pandemic began, we've been hearing about how doctors and hospitals have been losing a lot of money, but specifically the situation on the ground for family medicine practitioners, what's it like?
It's been tough. You know, physicians, much like other small businesses, patient visits and patient volumes really dried up at the beginning of the pandemic in March and April. Practices saw a drop off in patient visits of, you know, around 50 to 70%. Now, some of those practices were able to pivot to offer telemedicine or virtual services, but it didn't make up for the loss in volume.
70% a drop off in business. That's surprising, especially given the demand for testing and other things. But I want to go back to the Marshall Plan concept. Could you take us through some of the points of the proposal?
Sure. One of the biggest issues that COVID-19 really exposed about our healthcare system is the way in which we pay for services has some perverse incentives. We're currently on what's known as a fee-for-service model, which doctors get paid more for doing high-cost, low-value services as opposed to with the buckets that primary care falls into that are generally thought of as low-cost, high-value services. So they're paid on patient visits, you know, churn, getting patients in and out of the door. They're not paid on keeping patients healthy and avoiding higher cost problems down the road. And, you know, when the volume fell off 70%, it just exposed that that problem that we've been dealing with for frankly, a long time now.
So what would this plan do, though? What would the Marshall Plan, as you're describing it, do?
For about a decade, we have been testing alternative payment models for paying for physician services. That's manifested in things like accountable care organizations or episodes of care or bundled payments. Really what we're proposing is to step back and look at how primary care is paid and begin to transition away from fee-for-service and look at prospective payment or primary care capitation, where primary care physicians would be paid a set amount of money per patient per month, like you do for a Netflix subscription. It frees up the physicians from having to come up with a billable event where they can spend time and resources on the care that the patient needs, as opposed to, again, trying to generate revenue.
This sounds like what you're proposing is a very long-term strategy, something that would require legislation, not an airlift. Just how much of an emergency is this?
I think over the next 2 years, you're going to see a mass consolidation in the physician market. They will either join larger groups, they'll join health systems, they'll be bought by private equity. It's going to be very difficult for, small independent practices to survive. The thing about healthcare is that nothing has ever happened quickly, whether that's clinical interventions. When you think about after a heart attack, you're supposed to take baby aspirin. It's well known. It took 16 years for that to happen. The Marshall Plan, if you look historically, that actually happened 5 years, or I believe it was 3 years, after World War II ended. Mm-hmm. Looking beyond the pandemic, we're fighting really two fronts, right? We're still dealing with the first wave of the disease now. What the Marshall Plan envisions is, looking beyond COVID-19 and how we restructure our healthcare system that has plagued us for a long time. But you can't change 20% of the economy, which is tied to healthcare, overnight.
Tom Banning is CEO of the Texas Academy of Family Physicians, a trade group representing family doctors in the state. Tom, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
El Paso has long been considered a Democratic stronghold, a deep pocket of blue in a large red state, home to high-profile former congressman and presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke. The city is predominantly Latino and young. Both groups have historically low voter turnout. Angela Cuchergo with member station KTEP in El Paso talked with voters in the Texas border city about their concerns.
18-year-old Carla Gonzalez will be voting for the first time. Her pressing concern is finding a job. She's looking for work in downtown El Paso.
I'm willing to do anything, learning anything, construction even. I just want to do it for my little sister and my mom.
They live in Juarez, just across the border. Like many in El Paso, she has family in both Texas and Mexico. Gonzalez says COVID-19 has created economic hardship for all. As she waits for a job interview at a snack bar in El Paso's historic San Jacinto Plaza, just blocks from an international bridge, she reflects on Donald Trump's presidency.
Treat others the way you wanted to be treated. And the president, I'm not a fan of him. Not at all.
Gonzalez plans to cast a ballot for Joe Biden. David Ashcroft cannot decide if he wants to vote at all.
It kind of makes me sick to my stomach just knowing that I put one of these people in office. So I think the best thing for me was just to not vote.
The 21-year-old waiter is standing in the plaza near a fountain with a large sculpture of alligators. He's with a friend, Amanda Kilcrease. She's a 20-year-old college student who says she will vote, but reluctantly.
It just feels like if Trump wins again, and I didn't vote, I would have guilt with that too, that I didn't take a small action that could have had an opposite outcome. But I'm also not happy with the outcome of Biden. I just want to stress that I don't like either one.
This is also the site of the mass shooting at a Walmart 1 year ago August. That's on the minds of Marta Santiesteban and her husband. Her 90-year-old father was killed at the store. The young gunman from the Dallas area told police he drove to El Paso to, quote, stop the Hispanic invasion.
Invasion.
Yeah,
we're being
Mexicans
invaded
in the United States.
Yeah, I think the climate contributed 100%. This is on Donald Trump.
President Trump has his supporters in El Paso, too. Some of those voters were shopping at a farm supply and animal feed store on the western edge of El Paso, near the New Mexico state line. William Long was in the parking lot after picking up some dog food.
I'm pretty much going to probably vote for Mr. Trump, even though if he'd shut up sometimes, he'd be way ahead. But the only thing is, at least you know what's going on in that mind of his.
Voter Terry Manning was reluctant to talk about issues on his mind because of the divisive political climate, something he never imagined in El Paso, a place known for tolerance.
We grew up sharing different viewpoints and different cultures, and just everybody was together. But I have friends who've had their yard signs stolen, or once the sign was stolen, had eggs thrown at their house if they were for a particular candidate.
The music producer and photographer voiced his concerns after loading his pickup truck with bales of hay.
That's alfalfa hay. I've got 5 horses, 3 goats, and a donkey.
Across town, Omar Castañeda was buying parts at an auto supply store with his wife and 2 sons, ages 13 and 8.
Trying to get the kids back to go to school. I think it's important as far as socializing. I think it's a big part of growing up, and I think they need that.
He's also concerned about social justice.
Of course, you know, the whole Black Lives Matter and the whole racial thing going on, I think it's very important that they, you know, prioritize that during their presidency.
Castañeda has not decided who he will vote for yet, but after a tumultuous summer, he's ready to pay attention to the presidential race. In El Paso, I'm Angela Cocherga.
Monitoring the Talk of Texas on this Monday, social media editor Wells Dunbar. Hello, Wells.
Hi, David. As you noted, a scant 50 days to go until Election Day. And as controversy over the concept of voting by mail continues, a new supporter of the practice has emerged, Republican and past Texas House Speaker Joe Strauss. In an editorial for the Dallas Morning News, the former representative writes, "We all want our fellow Texans to be safe from the coronavirus, and we want elections conducted without fraud." Strauss says state and local officials must prepare adequately for an increase in mail-in ballots and make sure concerned Texans can vote. A state that refuses to recognize the unique circumstances of this moment is failing its citizens, he writes. While failing expanded voting by mail, folks are talking about other options. Via Twitter, Jeffrey writes, "We must vote and help everyone make a plan to vote." It's just one of the stories we're watching today, David. You know, I will be back with more reactions from social media later on in the program.
You know, that's true, Texas. And, of course, we need to hear from you. What's on your news radar on this start of the week? Reach out to us. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar, as he says, looking for you. And he's going to be back in about 35 minutes or so with more of the Talk of Texas.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Texas is suing, or I should say has been suing for some time, to strike down the Affordable Care Act. The Supreme Court is due to hear the case 1 week after Election Day. But that doesn't mean Democrats up and down ballot are waiting until after that date to make this an issue, as Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider explains.
During her first run for Congress in 2018, Democrat Lizzie Fletcher made protecting the Affordable Care Act one of her signature issues. She produced ads like this one, attacking her opponent, Republican Congressman John Culberson.
"We all know our health care system is broken, and Congress could help fix it. But John Culberson is taking a wrecking ball to it."
John Fletcher beat Culberson by 5 percentage points. She credits the win in large part to her stance on health care. She told me she sees that as the issue that could secure her re-election this year.
"Our health care is on the ballot this year. I think that it is, again, at the top of everyone's minds, especially in light of the COVID-19 pandemic."
And not just because of the pandemic. She says health care is on the ballot because Republicans put it there.
"Unfortunately, it is our state of Texas that's leading the charge in trying to repeal the entire Affordable Care Act. But we know that the Trump administration has refused to defend that law in court, that the president has said he does not support the Affordable Care Act and that the top of the ticket matters.
This election, Fletcher's opponent is Republican Wesley Hunt. He declined to speak for this story, though he emailed a statement saying that he would support protection for pre-existing conditions and work to lower the cost of prescription drugs. But just how big an issue is healthcare, and specifically the pandemic, likely to be for voters this time around? The Kaiser Family Foundation recently conducted a national poll and found that, as on so many issues, the electorate is polarized. Ashley Kurtzinger is with the foundation's polling unit.
What we found is for, you know, Democratic voters, the coronavirus is incredibly important to them. It's their top issue heading into the 2020 election. For Republican voters, it's less so. You know, a majority of Republican voters say it's the economy that's going to be driving their 2020 vote choice.
That encapsulates another closely watched congressional race in the Houston area, where Republican Congressman Dan Crenshaw is running for re-election.
You know, people care about their health. People care about recovering from the pandemic. They want their jobs back. And they want a strong economy going forward.
Crenshaw is an outspoken opponent of the Affordable Care Act. He's drawn heavy criticism from Democrats for that, especially from his opponent, attorney and breast cancer survivor, Seema Lajavardhan.
We live in a state that pretty much before the pandemic, one out of five Texans didn't have health care, and now it's one out of three. So it is extremely personal to me. I think we need to make sure that it's a human right, and we have to make sure that there is universal, high-quality health care for everyone.
Lajavardhan also accuses Crenshaw of not taking the pandemic seriously enough. Crenshaw is having none of it.
I'm the guy who actually bought 50,000 masks back in March or April when it was really hard to get masks and distributed them throughout the community. So for all the talk and tweeting that my opponent does, she's one of the richest people in Houston. She easily could have done something like that, but never did.
Both Dan Crenshaw, the Republican, and Lizzie Fletcher, the Democrat, are currently favored to win re-election. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Last Thursday, September 10th, marked the peak of the Atlantic hurricane season. In other words, that's the day that there's most likely to be a tropical storm or hurricane in the Atlantic Basin, at least according to statistics. And right now, meteorologists have identified seven systems in the Atlantic, ranging from tropical storms down to tropical disturbances. A busy season so far for sure, and now several offshore drilling platforms are hunkering down for their second potential hurricane in less than a month as a strengthening tropical storm, Sally, heads toward the Louisiana coast. Matt Smith has been watching all this and looking into their impact on the energy sector for Clipper Data, where he's director of commodity research. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you, David.
Now that the peak of the Atlantic hurricane season has passed, one might think, shouldn't it all be downhill from here? Not so.
You would hope so, but yeah, to your point, there's still a lot of different pockets of tropical activity. So Atlantic hurricane season doesn't actually end until the end of November, but it really does kind of drop off, particularly, you know, November time. But we still do see some hurricanes and that coming through, but much less so in October. All that said, as you mentioned, September 10th, you know, the peak of Atlantic hurricane season, on the same day it was announced that weather conditions have flipped to a La Nina. And what a La Nina is, it means below normal sea surface temperatures in the Pacific Ocean. And the reason this is important is because it could basically lead to more frequent and stronger hurricanes for the end of the Atlantic hurricane season.
Oh boy.
So we've already had a record hurricane season, and it looks like that could extend through into October here.
As an energy industry analyst, you have to be something of a meteorologist as well. Wearing that hat, Matt, what tropical activity do you currently see in the Atlantic that the industry is troubled about? I mean, we're talking from an energy perspective here.
Sure. So the main one is Tropical Storm Sally. You know, she's currently in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, and she's likely to make landfall tomorrow in eastern Louisiana. So not surprisingly, there's a state of emergency been declared there. But we have seen a refinery shut in Louisiana, and you're also seeing offshore platforms also being shuttered in the eastern Gulf of Mexico there. So that's a real concern, you know, from a human perspective and from an energy perspective. But elsewhere, you know, we've got Hurricane Paulette in the Atlantic, but that's sort of peeling off north away from the eastern seaboard. Another, you know, tropical storm Teddy as well has just formed in the mid-Atlantic. Shouldn't really affect things. So really the main focus at the moment is tropical storm Sally and the impact that that can have.
Yes, and the impact will be beyond the energy sector for certain. But, you know, you think about the fact that hurricanes happen every year. You mentioned the La Nina effect. Has this been an unusual season from the standpoint of the energy industry? Has the energy sector had to weather more storms than typical, or roughly the same as it stands?
Well, every Atlantic hurricane season, there are storms that come through and do either cause production to come offline or refineries to be shut in. So it isn't unusual. There just has been more frequently named storms this time around. And particularly, you know, if they go into the Gulf of Mexico, as opposed to peeling up the eastern seaboard, they are ultimately going to have more of an effect on the energy side of things.
More frequently named storms. Maybe this goes beyond your purview here, Matt, but is there a situation in which we would run out of names, and what then?
Sure. Well, we're nearly there, David. So with Teddy forming in the Atlantic, we've only got two names left. We've got Vicky and Wilfred left after that. And given what we've seen already, it's a nigh uncertainty that we're going to see those names used up. So what happens when you run through all of those names? You then have to move on to the names of from the Greek alphabet.
So alpha, beta, et cetera, has that happened before?
Apparently it has, yeah, back in October 2005, yeah. But it's a very rare occurrence, just really kind of speaks to how anomalous this hurricane season has been.
Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research for Clipper Data, keeping his eye on the skies. Matt, thanks again.
Thank you, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Terrazas. A bipartisan group of nearly 90 Texas lawmakers is calling on Governor Greg Abbott to develop a plan to expand broadband access in the state. The request comes as distance learning and remote working continues due to the coronavirus. Poor, elderly, rural, and non-native English-speaking households are less likely to have access to high-speed internet. According to the Texas Tribune, the lawmakers told the governor the issue can't wait until the next legislative session, which begins in January. Houston evictions haven't slowed down despite the CDC's national eviction moratorium. Houston Public Media's Jen Rice reports local housing advocates say the federal ban isn't making a difference so far.
The CDC argues keeping people in their homes during the pandemic is a public health emergency. Now the federal order to halt evictions through the end of 2020 has been in place for over a week, and attorneys say it's not working. Donna Carney with Lone Star Legal Aid says President Donald Trump and the CDC's intentions are clear.
The goal is to halt evictions as much as possible.
Renters are required to give their landlords a signed statement saying they've met the CDC qualifications. And Carney says that's just one of the hurdles they've seen in courts.
Tenants had provided the document with the declaration to their landlord, but because the document wasn't notarized, you know, signed before notary, it was rejected by the court.
Carney says that's not a valid reason to proceed with an eviction. A Houston Public Media review found in at least 100 eviction hearings last week, only one eviction was stopped by a judge using the moratorium. I'm Jen Rice in Houston.
A leading expert on the coronavirus says it's very unlikely a COVID-19 vaccine will be ready in October, despite President Trump's claim one could be available by then. Dr. Peter Hotez with the Baylor College of Medicine discussed the timeline with the Houston Chronicle this past Friday.
Well, it depends which year you're talking about. If you're talking about October 2021, I'm very optimistic we'll have several vaccines by October 2021, which is impressive. By this October, I do not see a path by which we'll have vaccines released to the public.
Hotez says at the earliest, a vaccine could be rolled out by the end of this year or the beginning of 2021. The Dallas Cowboys are taking stock of their loss to the Los Angeles Rams. Quarterback Dak Prescott spoke with reporters after last night's game.
There was good out there. There was something that we can grow on, but it's not anything that we wanted to start with or a feeling we'll ever be okay with.
The Cowboys play their second game of the season at home against the Atlanta Falcons this Sunday. I'm Lauren Tarrazas for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. There are all sorts of skills that can help students get a college scholarship these days. Athletics, of course, as well as academic excellence, talent in the arts, and apparently mastery of social media. College students who happen to be social media influencers are making deals to advertise for the very schools they attend. It's a fairly new practice, but one that appears to have some staying power. Joining us now to tell us more, Karen Freeberg. She is an associate professor of strategic communications at the University of Louisville. Professor Freeberg, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Really honored to be here. Thank you so much.
Tell us a little bit about how common these kinds of partnerships are between colleges and students who happen to be social media influencers.
It's definitely on the rise. And I've been at the University of Louisville for almost 10 years. And this really was a conversation that started happening over the last, I would say, good 6 or so years. It was not uncommon for us to have students coming in saying, yeah, I have about 10,000 followers on, you know, Instagram. Now we are getting students who are entering our classrooms. And I even teach at the University of Louisville social media courses where I have students saying, yeah, I'm verified on Instagram. And, oh, yeah, I've had a TikTok video that has gone viral. And so they are already in the mindset of building a community because they know that it could potentially lead up to, again, additional partnerships down the line. But it also is another way for them to be evaluated on how successful they are in terms of using social media strategically to perhaps get a job, an internship, stand out from the crowd. So,
well, but having said that, I mean, it's one thing for an individual to build one's own brand, but what sort of value do these partnerships potentially bring to the schools themselves?
One of the things to keep in mind is influencers as general are just another channel of communication. So what we are seeing is more universities kind of realizing, oh, the traditional channels of communication that we have been using may not necessarily be effective. And we're seeing that students are becoming influencers in their own right. And I think universities as a whole are thinking, well, why don't we go and work with them, partner with them? They're part of our community already. How can we make this a win-win situation for both parties?
You know, it's interesting because I think of ways that schools have reached out in the past, and merchandising has been one way. It doesn't just make money for the school, you know, the selling of T-shirts and that sort of thing. But it also, you know, it gets the word out. People become walking billboards for the university. How does this work in the world of social media? Are influencers given, say, a stipend or maybe some kind of discount on tuition in exchange for posts? How are they compensated?
Well, that's a really great question. So that really comes down to a university by university basis. But one of the things that I have seen is mostly most common merch. Students love swag. They love items that they're able to wear around and say, yes, I have this exclusive, you know, sweater that we only are able to get. So most common, they're either getting compensated by swag or they are getting compensated by the experiences. And so that's something to keep in mind. Influencers are not always driven by monetary incentives, but if they're able to get exclusives, like, okay, when football comes around, if they're able to get, you know, a really good experience firsthand because they're an influencer and share that with their community, that is more valuable to them than basically getting a paycheck.
And it seems like there is an ethical precipice that we might be sort of skirting here, or on the edge of, at least. Because on the one hand, we're talking about influencers, people on social media. Are they necessarily students at that school, or even students that are performing well? What you talk about, say, tickets to a sports event. How does a university ensure that a social media following might not play into an admissions decision, for example?
Absolutely. No, I mean, the ethical considerations are huge here. I mean, when I think of some of the influencers that I've seen with students at other universities, they're not even disclosing that they are basically getting compensated. And that's a big red flag from the FTC. But also, you know, like influence and followers, anyone can create a fake, you know, following. It is so easy to create the illusion of followers. And, you know, people look at vanity metrics in that way, rather than look, what is the actual influencer driving in terms of impact? And are they, as you said, even a student? Are they a good student? Have they worked through the process of gotten, you know, the traditional marks that we are looking for students who are coming into the university based on their scores, their experience? So I think that there is that fine line where we want to definitely engage in influencer marketing, but we want to do it in a way that follows certain ethical protocols, but also dotting the I's and crossing the T's to making sure that who we are partnering with are the real deal. Because the worst thing a university could do is partnering with an influencer that, one, is either fake or gets themselves into a crisis. So as universities move forward, they're going to have to really do a systematic analysis of who are the motivating individuals who are going to be persuasive and someone to trust.
Karen Freeberg is an associate professor of strategic communication at the University of Louisville. Professor Freeberg, thanks again for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much. It was a great honor to be here.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation.
My name is Sarah Maslin Neer, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times, but I'm also a secret horse obsessive, and my secret's out in my new book, Horse Crazy, The Story of a Woman and a World in Love with an Animal. The project of the book was unpacking why I love horses. As a reporter, my job description is one word, why. And I think a tremendous part of it was finding identity and belonging. But another part of it is that they healed me. I was the victim of a knife attack. I was actually stabbed by a robber who climbed through my window. And the world became incredibly loud after that. I could hear everything. It's called hypervigilance. It's a post-traumatic stress disorder. And horses communicate with silence. And being around them and realizing I could process the world in the safety of these giant creatures really helped me survive once again. One of the things I probe in the book is who do horses belong to? They've been wrapped up in Americana and elite trappings, and the truth is that they're democratic, that horses are part of a much broader American story than we've ever been led to believe. My father was a child Holocaust survivor. He liked to say that he was a 9-year-old boy that 80 million Germans wanted to murder. I said Germans instead of Nazis because he felt that Nazis sounded like a space trooper, and he wanted people to know that it was people who were capable of the atrocity. At the end of the war, he fled to freedom with the only conveyance left, which was an untamed, untrained 2-year-old mare. And throughout his life, the scent of horses felt like peace to him. And so in my book, I explore stories of equestrians who were erased from the American narrative. And I was particularly inspired by one Black cowboy. His name is Larry Callis, and he used his life savings to found the Black Cowboy Museum in Rosenberg, Texas. And Larry said to me, "Sarah, when I wore my cowboy hat, the white kids in school would say, 'You're not a cowboy.' And the Black kids in school would say, 'What do you think? Are you a white guy?' And he said, 'I'm a cowboy who's the son of a cowboy who's the son of a cowboy. I'm a cowboy whether God made me black or God made me white.'" Black people have been part of the American equestrian story forever. The first winner of the first ever Kentucky Derby was a Black man. In front of Churchill Downs, where the storied Kentucky Derby is run every year, there is a bronze of Secretariat, the Triple Crown winner, galloping with a rider on his back. And there's also a bronze of Aristides, that first winner of the first ever Kentucky Derby. But there's no rider on that horse's back. And I assure you, that's because that rider was a black man, and he was removed from the story. My name is Sarah Maslin Neer, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm also the author of a new book, Horse Crazy, the story of a woman and a world in love with an animal. And you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Given the prominence of the Black Lives Matter movement in recent months, there's been a push to support Black-owned businesses. Despite that, Black-owned enterprises are among the many businesses struggling during this pandemic, trying to withstand what some see as the worst economic conditions in generations. KERA's Elizabeth Mayong reports on one such Black-owned business with a distinctive Texas flavor.
The smell of freshly cooked barbecue wafts into the air as the tinfoil casing is pulled back from a hot rack of baby back ribs. At Off the Bone Barbecue in the Cedars, just south of downtown Dallas, co-owners Dwight Harvey and wife Rose Broussard say sales are down about 30% compared to a year ago. Their catering business plummeted when nearby offices shut down. Indoor dining capacity was cut significantly, then beef prices doubled. That forced the entrepreneurs to raise their menu prices.
It's day-to-day type thing. I mean, that's pretty much where we are at this point.
Day-to-day, month-to-month,
yeah.
Season-to-season.
Off the Bone did see a burst of business over the summer, as protests against police brutality led to new customers wanting to support Black-owned businesses. But Broussard says that first wave of support has faded. Elsewhere in Dallas, Smokey John's Barbecue also saw lots of new customers after the protests. But co-owner Juan Reeves says the influx has lasted.
There was a lot of interest and a lot of time taken to support Black-owned businesses, and we really got a boost from that.
This year, Smokey John saw the biggest Juneteenth sales in its history, up 400% compared to last year. But Reeves, who co-owns the restaurant with his brother Brent, is facing hurdles, like the cancellation of the State Fair of Texas. Juan calls the cancellation a huge blow. The brothers typically sell their barbecue at a booth, which brings in over a third of the business's annual revenue.
There's no way we could make all that up.
While the pandemic poses unique tests for Black barbecuers, they're part of a centuries-old legacy that has faced its share of challenges. Few people realize it's a history rooted in Native and Black America, according to Adrian Miller. He's a James Beard award-winning culinary historian and certified barbecue judge. Barbecue stretches back to a time when enslaved Black chefs served as pitmasters, but Miller says Black-owned restaurants and Black chefs often don't get the same recognition as their white counterparts.
If you look at the history of barbecue, African Americans have often been the standard bearers for great barbecue. So it's just ridiculous in this moment to not have African Americans celebrated for the significant contribution that they've made to this really popular food.
Like many other Black-owned businesses, it's that historical legacy that entrepreneurs are fighting to preserve during one of the most severe economic downturns in decades. More than 40% of Black-owned businesses in Texas say they could close because of the pandemic. That's according to a preliminary statewide survey from the Texas Association for African-American Chambers of Commerce.
This is really a lack of infrastructure to really support an entire community that needs capitalization. So we're really pushing for systemic change that we think will unredline access to opportunity.
That's Harrison Blair, the president of Dallas's Black Chamber of Commerce. He says part of that systemic change is finding innovative, long-term solutions, like Dallas-based entrepreneur Joseph Akintalayo. His My Cares app helped cut down the application process for federal stimulus aid from 3 hours to 30 minutes. Blair said through the app, his organization has helped over 300 small businesses get access to nearly $5 million in federal funding.
We think that this is something that will outlive the pandemic. So this will help a lot of small Black businesses who may not speak the language of banks quickly submit loan applications and really tell their story the way a bank is asking for it financially.
Juan Reeves of Smokey John's is excited about the growth of opportunities for Black entrepreneurs.
It affects households. There's a ripple effect in communities when you do that.
Reeves says he hopes there's continued momentum to support Black-owned businesses, because that empowers change to happen from within communities of color. I'm Elizabeth Mayong in Dallas.
You can learn more about the owners of Off the Bone and Smokey John's Barbecue. We have more information at texasstandard.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, dedicated to the fight against cancer through telemedicine, providing patients with the ability to conduct online virtual appointments. More at texasoncology.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The Alamo is in the midst of a massive redevelopment. There are big plans for the old San Antonio Mission, including a new museum and visitor center, an expanded footprint, and restoration of some original structures. The idea is to create a world-class experience that tells the whole history of the Shrine of Texas Liberty with a price tag of $450 million. But all those plans depend on a vote later this month by the Texas Historical Commission. That's according to the outgoing CEO of the Alamo Trust, Douglas McDonald, who joins us now on the Texas Standard. Douglas, welcome to the Standard.
Glad to be here.
First, an update on the status of the redesign. Where do things currently stand?
Well, we've got the conceptual designs pretty much together so people understand what the plans are for the site. As you described it, adding museum, really re-clarifying the site. You know, substantially, people come to the Alamo today and many leave and say, is that all? Is there not more? And they don't understand that the Alamo was really the fortress, the mission footprint. It was the mission that was in front of the church, and they think that the entire Alamo was a church. So this really opens up and clarifies and restores that entire footprint, which would be exciting to the public.
Mm-hmm. Next week, as I mentioned, the Texas Historical Commission is going to vote on moving the cenotaph, which is a giant monument to the Alamo defenders. Can you tell us a little bit more about the history of that and why the plan to move it?
Well, there have been a lot of plans to move it over the years. This is actually the fifth attempt to try and improve the Alamo site. Many of those have included relocating the cenotaph. And we feel like if we're trying to create an 1836 site and a historic site, that a 60-foot monument in the center of a site where the primary building of that site is supposed to be the 35-foot tall church really creates a problem. This is a great opportunity to re-clarify the site. So the Texas Historical Commission has to approve this permit, and that allows us to move forward.
Am I correct in saying the cenotaph was built for the centennial in 1936 or thereabouts?
It was built for the centennial in 36. It was dedicated in 1940. It was controversial when it was put in place. The Daughters Republic of Texas opposed the location that was chosen. Capini, the artist, wanted it in the center of the Alamo. The Daughters lost that battle, and it was put where Capini wanted it. We are putting it back where the Daughters wanted to have it placed originally.
Well, now, last week you told the San Antonio Business Journal that if the Historical Commission denies the application to move this cenotaph, then the rest of the development could be scrapped. And what, the money spent up to now would be wasted? Why is that?
No, I think what you'll find if the THC doesn't approve this is you'll find that the city will go ahead and will create a nice southern end Alamo Plaza. It'll be an urban development, urban space, but you won't see the museum. You won't see the reclaimed footprint or visit the Trevino House where Travis wrote those world-renowned letters.
One of the things that's fascinating to me about this is that this issue can evoke such a passionate response from people on both sides. Why has this been so controversial? Why is it, or does it remain controversial today? I guess this ties back to Texas history and interpretations.
You know, my observation in being part of this project now for almost 4 years is that people love to fight over the Alamo instead of fighting for the Alamo. And they love to fight about the Alamo as opposed to fighting for it. We're really fighting for the Alamo. We're fighting for a plan that actually allows the millions of people who come here to have a great experience, to understand the history and understand what it meant, but understand not just the history of 1836, but the history of the Spanish colonial era, understanding why it was the missionaries came here to settle this area, understand why it was that people in San Antonio decided they would go fight the Spanish forces at Medina in 1813, where they were fighting for independence from Spain at that point. I mean, this is a powerful story that transformed the Western Hemisphere, and that simply is unknown and untold today. And this is one opportunity in the lifetime of Texans to actually tell the story, to tell it right, and to tell, I think, one of the most important historical narratives in the Western Hemisphere, which is hugely diminished by the kind of sight that we experience today.
Any indication which way the vote might go?
We expect them to do the right thing. We have gone through the votes of City Council. We have gone through the votes of the Texas Historical Commission, the Historic Design Review Committee, the Planning Commission. Every one of these groups has overwhelmingly supported this. This is the last step in a long process, and we can't imagine that people want to see a plan that has been planned and worked on for 6 years and to see it jettisoned at this late moment.
Douglas McDonald is the outgoing CEO of the Alamo Trust. Douglas, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar, monitoring social media. Wells, welcome back.
Hey, good to be back, David. We're hearing from our friends and listeners out there about the subject just at hand, that $450 million redevelopment plan for the Alamo. And one of our friends on Twitter, Tex1Sam, he disregards any of the controversy surrounding the cenotaph. He tweets, I guess echoing some of what we just heard, that they should move the cenotaph and create what he calls a coherent plaza. And I know, obviously, as we just heard, that has been a controversial plan ever since it was put into place. And really speaks to that broader, rethinking the broader area there around the Alamo. You know, for my money, David, I think maybe the biggest change would just be moving the Ripley's, believe it or not, all the sort of carnival attractions there across the street.
Yeah. I remember once upon a time, you know, I don't know if you know this, Phil Collins, the musician, is huge. He's all over the Alamo and its legends, and he has a huge collection. He donated it to the state of Texas. And I can remember, when we went down and talked with him, this kid was just leaving the Alamo. He must have been 7 years old, and he said, "Is that it?" You know, after he comes out of the Alamo. And I think that's what a lot of officials are trying to. They're trying to make it so that it matches a lot of the myth. But another part of this is making it so that the bigger story is told. It's not just the sort of mythology.
Yeah, quick trip through the church there, and then on to the gift shop. I know. And no basement to boot either. So what are you going to do? Following up on a quick story we were talking about yesterday, Texas has given its preliminary approval to those revised sex ed policies that were being discussed. We heard about that last week. Notably, one change there is does discuss birth control options other than abstinence, but this vote to proceed did not include any mention of LGBTQ issues or LGBTQ identity issues. Moreover, the board rejected proposals that would teach about the importance of consent. And that's one thing that our friends and listeners are singling out here on Facebook. Tim Figler says, "While I don't agree with the LGBTQ exclusion, I understand it's a hot topic and the board isn't there just yet, unfortunately. But why on God's green earth would anyone not want to teach consent?" he asks. Obviously, owing to the controversy that that sex ed and the state's role in governing the teaching of those topics continues to generate. So obviously not a done deal yet, but this preliminary vote, a good signal on how things could shake out there. Just scanning the headlines, see this from the Texas Tribune. Apparently the Biden campaign staffing up in Texas. They're the campaign's adding 13 members to the team here, where I guess they could consider making a run for it here in Texas.
Well,
we've seen
a lot of
different polling recently come out between the
I was going to say, the polls show that it's a pretty close, tighter race than a lot of people anticipated just a couple of years ago. So it'll be interesting to see how that all turns out. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but the news continues 24/7, in fact, over at texasstandard.org. I'm David, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the crew. We'll be back here tomorrow, and we hope you will join us.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.